All right, if people can come on in. First of all, I have just a couple housekeeping things. Lo siento, no hablo español, but Jillian does.
¿Alguien necesita traducción en español? Levante la mano. Okay, gracias.
Gracias. Welcome, brothers and sisters. This mic is just here for sound. It doesn't amplify. So if you're having trouble hearing me now, you should move forward, because Jack Bryson is even quieter than I am, and you're going to want to hear what he has to say. So if you're having trouble hearing me, there's plenty of seats up here in the front, and you should move forward. So first of all, this is Legal Lynching in America, Oscar Grant, Mass Incarceration and the Death Penalty. My name is Cameron Sturdivant, and I want to welcome you all to Oakland, California. I want to welcome you to West Coast Socialism 2010, Ideas That Can Change the World. I want to encourage you to come back after tonight and join us in discussing politics and activism all weekend long here at the hotel. There's a couple things that I need to let you know about. There's just been a lot happening on this issue around the United States, in Illinois, in Georgia, and here in California. And I'm going to set the stage for just a moment for a couple reasons. One is it's important for you to hear some of this stuff and just kind of frame the discussion we're about to have. But also, Jack Bryson, as you know, the father of Jackie and Nigel, who were Oscar's friends, were on the platform with him, has been down in Los Angeles at Johannes Mezzali's murder trial. He is flying up here. He actually just landed at the Oakland airport. We have a comrade out at the airport to bring him right here. So he's going to be a few minutes late. So we're going to put some of this stuff at the beginning of the discussion, and Jack's going to be joining us a little bit later, but he will be here. So first of all, you know, on Monday of this week in Illinois, John Burge was found guilty of lying and conspiracy and torture. It gives me goose shivers, because when I was just a wee lad, I remember going to protests. At the time, I lived in the Midwest. We went to protests about police torture in Area 2 in Chicago. And to know that 37 years after the first charges were brought, that this man, he wasn't actually convicted of torture, because there's a statute of limitations, and that has expired. But he lied. It's just like Martha Stewart. He lied about it, though. And so that is what, but that opens the door for his for civil prosecutions. It opens the door for men who have said for decades that they were innocent to actually now be believed and have it be official, have it be on the record. And that is that part of it is a tremendous victory. But it's really the green light, the green flag to say now we start to organize to get restitution for these people, for the other men who are on either in prison or on death row, for their cases to move forward and be brought out of those jails, and for John Burge to be marched off into a prison to have his boat named the Vigilante, which he was hired with in Florida, to have his boat, his house. I want his pension. I want all of it. And I want that given to those men. Anybody who saw the men who were tortured and tormented by this guy when they were released, you cannot help but be just because there really is no way to make them whole for that part of their lives that they missed. There is really nothing that can be done, but there is something that can be done to make sure it doesn't happen again. Troy Davis, on death row in Atlanta for the killing of a police officer 21 years ago, was granted a hearing by the United States Supreme Court, something that any of us in the death penalty movement, that is what we want to have happen in our cases. We want the U.S. Supreme Court to say, yes, there is something here which needs to be looked at. That actually has happened. It's now being deliberated. The judge is thinking about whether or not the tremendous burden that was put on Troy Davis and his attorneys will be met. But the only reason we got here was because of the tremendous effort of Troy, his family, in particular his sister Martina Correa, who we've had out here speaking in the Bay Area, and she's been around the world, a tireless effort, his attorneys, and the nationwide effort of activists to make sure that this case did not just go away. In California, this is really the least lustrous of the things I'm going to tell you about, but the Office of Administrative Law did just reject the proposed lethal injection regulations drafted by the Department of Corrections, citing numerous serious problems. This was in part because of objections raised by the public in hearings around these lethal injection protocol problems, which have put in place an effective moratorium on executions here in California, the state with the largest death row in the United States. That what they're going to find is that there is no right way to do the wrong thing. And that's what we've been saying over and over. There is no good way to kill innocent people. There's no good way to punish using racism, using the broken system that they call the criminal justice system. I think we call it the criminal injustice system. And I'll say just a bit more about California in just a moment. But I think it's also important to say that in California, of course, we could not have this meeting tonight and not acknowledge the fact that the murder trial of Johannes Mezzoli is moving to a rapid conclusion. It could be decided while we're here at this conference. And the assembly point for the demonstration, the response to the verdict, is at 14th and Broadway, 6 p.m. on the day that the verdict is announced. We would encourage, you know, the conference has plans to send, probably not all of us, but a good chunk of us, to go down and participate. But certainly people who have been involved in this struggle for the year and a half, almost 2 years, well, year and a half that this has been going on, we will be going down there because if the verdict is a victory for our side, it will be historic. It will be the first time that a police officer has been charged and held accountable for murder that they committed while they were on the job. And the fact that Mezzoli was actually put in jail, arrested in Nevada, where he had gone to think about what he had done. I can assure you that nobody else would have been allowed to go to Nevada to think about what they had done. The fact that his bail was set at $3 million, that means that at least some of his relatives had to mortgage their house to raise that money. Those things have been stepped forward for us. And now what we want to see is actual justice for Oscar Grant and for the young men who were on the platform with him. We are here to fight for the living. And that's what connects our struggle against the death penalty with the struggle for justice for Oscar Grant. We want justice for the young men who were horribly mistreated, brutalized on the platform with him. And I do want to now come back just to one other thing about California, because this meeting tonight is being co-sponsored by the campaign to end the death penalty. I myself am a member of the campaign to end the death penalty, and I'm a monthly sustainer. I want to encourage all of you to become a monthly sustainer as well. I would like to have Crystal Bybee, who is here with us tonight, to come forward and say just a few words about the case of Kevin Cooper. We have a petition that we would like you to sign. We would like you to find out more about his case. But the campaign to end the death penalty is at the table at the back. We also have information about the demonstration that is being organized for the Oscar in the case of Oscar Grant. Both of those groups are sitting at the back with the table. But Crystal, if you could just come forward and say a few words.
Okay, thanks, Cameron. I would be happy to, and I'm going to pass this petition actually while I'm speaking. So if everybody could please sign, we actually have another one in the back with Carol and Pat in the back. This petition is for Kevin Cooper, who's an innocent man on death row in California. This petition is to Attorney General Eric Holder, asking him to launch an investigation into the violations of Kevin Cooper's civil and constitutional rights. Kevin Cooper's struggle is one that when you read his story, we have more information about him on the back. If you don't know his story, it reads a lot like the stories of Mumia Abu-Jamal, of Troy Davis, men that have been put on death row and have spent decades fighting and fighting and fighting to prove their innocence. And you know what the courts say every time? You're too late. You didn't say this early enough. There's some technical thing that prevents us from actually reviewing your case and giving you justice. And in California, I think it's been even more than that. The powers that be have gone out of their way since the day they decided to arrest Kevin Cooper to make sure that he was the one to take the fall for a crime that happened. He was framed, and they have continued to do everything in their power to keep him on death row. If it weren't for what Cameron said about the lethal injection challenge in California, They would be setting an execution date for him right now. He lost his last appeal in front of the U.S. Supreme Court on November 30th of last year, and right now no one is getting execution dates in California. And part of the reason is Cameron's right, because of the public outcry over executions, and that goes back to the fight that we waged to save Stanley Tookie Williams. And because Barbara Becknell, who is traveling around the world and unfortunately can't be with us here this evening, because she was able to witness Stanley Tookie Williams being tortured and murdered and come out and explain the torture and what happened to him, that is a large part of the reason and the movement that many people in this room were a part of, that is set in motion the chain of events that led us where we are today. So I just want to say that it's an incredibly important time for Kevin Cooper, for the California death penalty, that we need people to get involved. We don't want to just wait until they say, okay, we've tinkered with the system, we have a brand new shiny death chamber, we want to start executing people again, and then they will have dozens, maybe more people lined up, ready to go, like they do in Texas, to be executed. And we know that if we wait until then to do the organizing, the protesting, the marching, the letter writing, and the petition signing, that we may be too late. So I really encourage everyone to find more about Kevin Cooper and his story, and I'm sure that you'll be compelled to get involved and fight for his freedom. And the website is savekevincooper.org, and that's actually going through a big transformation, so soon it will have lots of exciting new things that I won't tell you, so you can come check it out yourself.
I'm proud to have worked on the Kevin Cooper campaign and visited Kevin. And I think that his story is part of the inspiration that really set up this meeting tonight about legal lynching, about a practice of administering justice on the limb of a tree. To join us tonight to help with this discussion, I'm really pleased and honored to be up here, hopefully soon with Jack, but also right now with Liliana Segura. She's an alternate staff writer and editor of the Rights and Liberties section, as well as the world special coverage that is provided on that site. She writes for Counterpunch. She writes for The New Abolitionist, which I just happen to have a copy of right here. And so if you read The New Abolitionist, you'll see the words of Liliana Segura right next to the men and some of the women who are on the row, because our job as in the campaign is we want to help get the voices of inmates themselves out to talk about what their cases are. So we have Keeping It Real in here. If you can, I encourage you to check out the campaign and the death penalty table and get a copy of that. But without any further ado, let's hear from Liliana.
Thank you.
It's not amplified.
Can everyone hear me? Yeah? Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much for having me tonight. It really is an honor to be in Oakland right now at this critical moment in the Oscar Grant, in the case around the Oscar Grant murder. I've been watching it closely from New York. I've been following the Twitter feed on the case. It's really a testament to the work of activists like you guys and the work of activists like Jack that people in New York and all over the place know the name Oscar Grant because there are many, many more cases like it that have remained anonymous. And so it really, it captures perfectly for me the power of activism in shining a spotlight on these injustices that happen so often. It especially resonates with me, too, coming from New York. When I was thinking about it earlier this morning, I was thinking about all of the cases that sound so familiar. You know, this happens so often, it seems. You know, another outrageous case of an unarmed African-American man, you know, shot to death by the cops in the streets. And you always know how the story goes. You know, they're killed, it's outrageous, and then nothing happens. You know, no one is ever brought to justice. And I was thinking back to February of 2000, when only a few months after I moved to New York myself, and I'll never forget, I was at the movies in Times Square, and I was all excited to be in New York, and, you know, it was kind of cool. And I was watching this movie, and I came out into Times Square, and I looked up at the kind of that obnoxious Dow Jones news scroll that has all the headlines, and I looked up, and there was this headline just shouting at me that said, you know, the four officers acquitted in the Amadou Diallo case. Four white police officers found not guilty in this case where this unarmed black man had been shot to death 41 times on his front porch. And I remember staring at that headline in shock, and it was Times Square was around me, and it was all chaos, and it just felt like all of that noise, like suddenly the city was just on the verge of explosion. And it's not that there were suddenly protests out in the streets, although that certainly followed, especially in the Bronx that night, when the verdict came down from Albany. Of course, they moved the case to Albany so that it would be a fair trial for these officers. You know, never mind that there was no fair trial for Amadou Diallo, who was shot in the streets and killed. Forget that part. And I just was in shock that the cops could get away with murdering a person like this. And I thought that's just an exception, that doesn't happen. Well, I was obviously pretty naive. I would come to discover over the years in New York, it just seemed like every few months, every few years, there was some outrageous case that seemed to outdo the next one. So in 2004, there was Timothy Stansbury, who was a 19-year-old kid in Bed-Stuy, who was on the roof of a housing project, just hanging out. It was at nighttime, and for whatever reason, there were cops patrolling, as they often do in New York, in certain parts of the city. And this 19-year-old kid was shot once in the chest by this officer who, I guess, was alarmed that someone was coming out of a stairwell. So he was shot and killed. In 2006, there was the Sean Bell case, which many of you have probably heard of. You know, also a young guy in Queens on the early morning hours after his bachelor party on the day of his wedding, shot to death by the cops also. Defenders of the police officers would say, oh, he was driving drunk, he was leaving a strip club, you know, what kind of guy was this? You know, last I heard, those aren't capital offenses. You know, it doesn't justify it. There was no justification for it. And we saw the protest then as well. And so the topic of this talk tonight is legal lynching. And we in the campaign to end the death penalty, I'm also a member, I'm on the board, I've been a member for a long time. It's really the campaign that sort of radicalized me around this issue about 10 years ago. And I'm so grateful for that because it's really because of the campaign that I'm here, not because of my journalism. I came to journalism through activism, not the other way around. Thank you. So we in the campaign often frame wrongful executions or the racist death penalty in terms of legal lynching, because it's a really useful way to understand what we see. Why do we see, you know, black and brown people being shot down in the streets literally now in 2010? Well, it goes back to this legacy of institutional racism. It goes back to, you know, none of this is going to be news to you guys, but this is the way we discuss this in the campaign to end the death penalty. It's a different approach from a lot of mainstream abolitionist groups. And I think that's really important. It's important to take that concept of legal lynching and to try to expand it and kind of take a step back. And at this moment where we're actually seeing the death penalty on the decline in this country in many places, it's important that we broaden what we consider to be legal lynching, what we broaden our concept of what's an execution, what's a wrongful execution. It doesn't just happen, in cases like Troy Davis, where they've tried now three times to execute this man, and it's really because of activism that he's still alive. But I would argue that Timothy Stansbury, Sean Bell, Amadou Diallo, Oscar Grant, those are wrongful executions. That is murder. These people were executed. And I think we need to really start saying that and start owning that and as activists really use that as a way into the discussion of how we connect the death penalty and what we often refer to as police brutality or even police torture. You know, all of this falls under the same heading. So I wanted to bring that. And then just to take a step back, speaking of trends like the death penalty on the decline, this morning I was on the plane, and I was reading The Nation, which, you know, is a magazine I respect and have written for, and Dave Zirin obviously writes for The Nation, and, you know, I consider it to be on our side. And there's this cover story that is actually very important by Sasha Abramsky, who's a journalist whose work probably a number of you know. He has written for years about the prison system, especially in California. He's, you know, one of the good guys. And the topic of the article is this the end of the war on crime? And it's this long feature that has a lot to offer in the way of kind of identifying trends that are very positive in terms of the criminal justice system and mass incarceration in this country. I just wanted to pause to welcome Jack. How am I doing with time, by the way?
Only 5 minutes. You've only been
5 minutes. Oh, okay. So I would encourage people to check it out. It's online, and it basically it's actually kind of a reason to celebrate the fact that for the first time in decades we're seeing a trend writ large where the prison population is actually appears to be dropping in many places. In 2008, I think the prison population fell in 20 states. In 2009, last year, it fell in 26 states. 2010, this year, it's sort of slated, that trend is slated to continue. And there are many reasons for this. One of the immediate causes right now that's very important is that the financial crisis we find ourselves in as a country, and especially here in California, has basically forced politicians to you know, finally confront the fact that we've all been screaming about for years, which is that we can't afford, I mean, forget affording it on a moral level, on a political level, we can't afford it financially, these monstrous prisons that swallow up so much of our resources, that swallow up so much human potential. And so politicians who are so cynical and build their careers on tough on crime posturing have finally kind of taken a look at these old ideas of restorative justice, of sentencing alternatives, of drug treatment, of health care, all of these things, and said, huh, maybe we should try some of these things out. And it's not only that reason that we're going to see a decline in the prison population, but the fact that these ideas are getting any kind of traction is extremely important and extremely positive, and I think we need to build on that. And so this article laid that out, and it was really pleasing to read that and to see that it's a cover story in The Nation. Even a good publication like The Nation doesn't always cover criminal justice issues as much as I would like them to. So I really think that this trend of criminal justice reform is getting out there to the kind of mainstream. On the other hand, as I read it, I kind of felt this nagging feeling that the piece was incomplete. That, you know, it was a good feature. It was well reported. It had a lot of good statistics, identifying trends kind of on the large scale. But what I realized was missing is something that actually Cameron laid out very well in talking about the new abolitionist, and that was any voices of any person who has actually been affected on a personal level, who's actually had their freedom taken away, who's actually had to go and devote hours and tons of money and, you know, so much of their lives to go visit people, relatives, loved ones in prison. That kind of human element of what it means to have so many people in prison was totally lost. And so we had people, you know, it quoted from think tanks, people in the drug legalization movement. James Q. Wilson is quoted in the piece, you know, one of the pioneers of the broken windows policing theory that helped lead us to this enormous mess, you know, who was Nixon's favorite sociologist. He's quoted, and you know, just for the record, does not regret his theories of yore, but just sort of sees the country moving in a different direction. So, you know, I have a lot of respect for Sacha Obronsky, and this is, you know, I don't criticize his reporting at all, but I do think that it was a very telling omission in this piece that there wasn't a place for the voice of prisoners or exonerated prisoners or family members. And I really think that that's where we as activists have to step in, and that's why I as a journalist have tried to tell the human stories that I have learned as an activist. That I think is the most powerful way you tell the story of what's unjust about the criminal justice system. You know, we've had a series of very good Supreme Court rulings in recent years. We had Roper versus Simmons in 2005, which declared that the death penalty was unconstitutional for juveniles, for minors, and that was a huge deal. More recently, just a few months back, we had Graham versus Florida, which declared that life without parole is also unconstitutional for juveniles operating on. Or, I'm sorry, not for juveniles, all juveniles, but just people who are convicted of non-homicides. So it's actually a very small fraction of the number of kids under 18 who are sentenced to life without parole. And those are important steps. Those are important victories. Even the Supreme Court ruling in 2008 about life without parole, or I'm sorry, about lethal injection, Bays versus Reese, ultimately the decision worked against us. It upheld Kentucky's lethal injection protocol, and that was horrible. On the other hand, that case created a de facto moratorium for months, 9 months, during which no one was executed in this country. Not for lack of trying on behalf of certain states, but it really zeroed in a lot of people's attention on the way we kill people. And that was a very positive thing, I think, in terms of public education. But you look at these court decisions and the years that pass in between them, and how many people, you know, how many prisoners have died in the meantime? How many families have been torn apart because they continue to have to build their entire lives around a loved one who's in prison? I mean, all of the human elements are lost and unaddressed in these Supreme Court cases. So, thank you. And so again, I think that our jobs as activists is not to just sort of accept these victories, these Supreme Court rulings that work in our favor as victories, but to really push the envelope and to infuse a sense of urgency, of human urgency in the people who are actually affected or not by these rulings. You know, I think for us as activists and as human beings, it's intolerable. It's intolerable that Troy Davis is still on death row after all of these years, that he's faced the execution chamber 3 times. I mean, that itself is a form of cruel and unusual punishment. It's cruel and unusual for his family. It's cruel and unusual for those who have to sort of live and die according to the whims of these court, these hearings. I think it's intolerable that there are still innocent people locked up in Illinois who were the victims of police torture under Burge's thugs. There are still people, and the folks in the campaign and other activists in Illinois and Chicago have been incredible. I mean, truly incredible at just keeping their voices raised against this injustice. I think it's intolerable that Montel Johnson, another prisoner whose case I came to through the campaign, this is a prisoner who I believe now he weighs somewhere between 70 and 80 pounds. He is suffering from multiple sclerosis, very debilitating illness, and has been locked up in Illinois for years, was given a commutation, an executive clemency by Governor Blagojevich based on his condition, but remains in a sort of state of legal limbo because Governor Schwarzenegger here in California is trying to get him extraordinarily rendered, this is the language they use, rendered back to California despite that this man is dying in order to serve out a life sentence for another crime that he was convicted of previously. This is happening right now in California, and I encourage you to look it up. Montel Johnson's mother, Gloria Johnson, is one of the bravest, most tenacious, amazing people I've ever met. She keeps a blog, or used to keep a blog, until they basically told her to shut it down, in which she would document her visits with Montel and how they would deny him the care that he had a right to. It's an incredible, intolerable case, and I think it's our job as activists to shine lights on those cases too. You know, no sooner had I sort of picked up this kind of good news issue of The Nation than I read an article on MSNBC.com about a prisoner named Adam Montoya who died in federal prison recently. The headline was, Adam Montoya died in agony while pleading for help. And this is a man who, as it turned out, suffered from no fewer than 3 serious illnesses, cancer, hepatitis, and HIV. The cancer ultimately killed him, causing his spleen to burst. Montoya bled to death internally. And I just have to read the rest of this because I think this is another form of a death sentence that we don't think about. This is a man who, by the way, was in prison for, I think, 2 years for bouncing checks, writing bad checks, something like that. But the coroner and a pathologist were more stunned by another finding. The only medication in his system was a trace of over-the-counter pain reliever. That means Montoya, imprisoned for passing counterfeit checks, had been given nothing to ease the excruciating pain that no doubt racked his body for days or weeks before death. I just happened to catch this case, you know, in passing through an email chain. And these are cases that, I mean, this is happening in Illinois. It's happening all over the country. I mean, we have the health care system in our country, I don't need to tell you, is a scandal in this country. The healthcare system, or lack thereof, in prisons is so brutal, you know, we can barely even think about it. So, you know, this man was sentenced to 2 years, but it became a death sentence. And I just think that we need to be conscious of all of the ways in which our criminal justice system continues to kill people, quite literally. I want to start to wrap up, but I just was thinking about the Kevin Cooper, what you were talking about with Kevin Cooper and all these individual cases. And I think back on the 10 years I've been a member of the campaign. And I remember at the start when I joined, you know, we kind of had tensions with other abolitionist groups who used to caution us that really it wasn't a good idea to rally around individual cases, that kind of approach wasn't the right approach. It was too narrow. It was too, you know, it just wasn't the right strategy. And we would always push back. And I remember I didn't know enough as an activist to kind of understand why it was so important that we push back on that. But what we've done in the campaign has been to prove those naysayers wrong every time. And it's been true in Kevin Cooper's case. It's been true in the case of Troy Davis. It was true in the case of Ryan Matthews, who was a kid who, before the Roper decision came down, he was on death row in Louisiana for a crime he didn't commit. There have been so many individual cases where activism has made a difference. In New York, I was very proud a few years back when when New York State, when the State Assembly suspended the death penalty, kind of out of the blue, it seemed, and then based on some technicality regarding jury sentencing. And they decided to hold hearings, the Assembly did in New York, on whether or not there was the appetite to bring back the death penalty. And a bunch of us testified from the campaign, and that was very exciting. But in the lead-up to those hearings, we had to debate other activists who were saying, you know, we really shouldn't have exonerated prisoners come. This guy, he's too angry, he'll scare the legislators, he's not going to, you know, he's going to be too off-putting, don't do that. They wanted to take a very cautious approach. And I remember there's this horrible discussion about pins, what pins we should wear. It was like, are you serious? You know, we're talking about pins, we're talking about bringing human beings, like actual exonerees, people who can tell their story and put a human face on this injustice. And in the end, you know, we won that argument, and we flew in exonerated prisoners who were working with the campaign at the time. And I'll never forget when the legislators heard their testimony, you could hear a pin drop. And months later, when the report came out from the legislator saying that New York was not going to make any moves to reinstitute the death penalty, the only specific testimony that was brought up in this kind of long 50-page document, however long it was, were the exonerated prisoners that we had fought to bring to the table. And so it was an incredibly vindicating thank you. Thank you. So those moments are very vindicating, but I also think we have to learn from them and teach them and hold on to our strategy and know that it's working, even when it's unpopular in the room of kind of those people with access and who hire lobbyists and kind of aren't about the radical politics that the people in this room are about. And I want to wrap it up with that. The one other thing I wanted to bring up that just for me is so emblematic of what we're up against in terms of not ceding anything to the courts, not waiting around for these decisions to come down for us, is that, you know, I was watching the Elena Kagan confirmation hearings this week. You know, no radical there, no big surprise, but somebody asked her about the death penalty. And she said that she has no moral qualms about upholding the death penalty. And on one hand, it was totally unsurprising, but on the other hand, the idea that she would say she has no moral qualms, when we know that Texas executed Cameron Todd Willingham, who was an innocent man, we know for a fact, and this is common knowledge, this is out in the world, the fact that our leaders, our most powerful leaders, continue to worship this fiction that the death penalty is, that there's anything moral about it, is really sick, and it's something that we have to remember that, you know, the trends in the criminal justice system may be getting better, but we really have to keep doing what we're doing and step it up and make it urgent, make it count. Thank you.
I just want to give you a little roadmap before I bring Jack up. So Liliana's gone. Jack's going to speak for about 10, 15, 20 minutes, and then we're going to open up for discussion. So I didn't want you to think that you were just going to have to sit here and listen to us. We are going to have plenty of time for discussion. And without any further ado, though, this is history, and this is how history unfolds. The people who are in the thick of the battle exhaust themselves, exhaust their bank accounts, moving around the country, talking about the cases, and in that tradition, I want to welcome Jack Bryson. He's one of my personal heroes, but also somebody I'm proud to know as a friend that I got to know through the Oscar Grant case. His sons were on the platform, and as I said at the beginning, before Jack arrived, I want to publicly announce this again, is that it's for those young men, for the living. We are fighting for those young men as well as for justice for Oscar Grant. And with that, please welcome Jack Bryson.
Sorry.
You just have to talk out. It's not for amplification.
Oh.
Sorry, you just got to talk to him.
I might have to yell then.
Yeah, yell at him.
I just want to thank everyone, you know, for your support and everything. I knew that was coming from Gerald. I'm sorry for being late. Today was a long day. It was closing statements, and so it was only supposed to take like 4 to 5 hours. David Stein did an excellent job saying that Johannes Mezley should go to prison for second-degree manslaughter. And he did an excellent job. It only took him 2.5 hours. And then Michael Raines, man, that dude is one big moron idiot. I mean, man, just sitting there watching him talk, and he's talking about the DA doesn't want to seek the truth for justice. Well, the DA did seek the truth for justice. You know, he did a real good job. And then as I'm sitting here, he's telling he you know, I have to sit there because I'm like, man, his closing statements were about Oscar and my son, and the lies that they've done. And I'm like, man, I can't sit. I feel like doing the Tim Killings because, I just couldn't sit there too much longer and just let him degrade my son just over and over and over and degrade Oscar over and over and over.
This, you can't I wish hear, this, you have to come forward, yeah. Folks. It's not amplified. But, it's a big room, so please just exit on the airplane and in the court. So if you can't hear, please move over.
But so today, you know, there was some, while we're sitting in court, you know, I believe we're like that close to putting this police officer away. But then as I look at the jury, I don't know what to think. You know, it's like now I understand why they have white jurors, because I guess white jurors can relate to what Michael Raines is saying. What he's hoping is that, you know, be sentimental to my, you know, to Johannes Mezley. And when you look at Johannes Mezley, I mean, I don't mean to be disrespectful, but he is one of the dorkiest, clumsiest looking dudes you would ever see, you know. And when he took the stand, it was just ridiculous how he started crying. And what they're saying, like today, Michael Raines said that him and Oscar, that my son attacked Johannes Mezley, punched him twice, and Oscar attacked Johannes Mezley. And he's telling the jury, this is not what you see on the video, but this is what I'm telling you. This is the truth. And then he said Johannes Mezley and Oscar got into a fight, a tussle, and he lands on top of Oscar Grant, and he looks at Oscar Grant, and Oscar Grant looks at him. And they're just staring at each other. And it was like, excuse my language, I said, what the fuck, are you trying to make this seem like a love scene or something? You know, that he falls on top of Oscar Grant and he's trying to be polite to Oscar Grant, but yet he turns around and kills Oscar Grant? What kind of shit is that? You know, and then I'm thinking, and then I'm just looking at the jury because I'm saying, damn, this system is unfair to black young, just to blacks, period. If you're black and you're chosen for jury, and now I just realized I learned a lot through the jury system, just watching them pick all the jurors. And every time they ask the potential black juror a question, have you ever been in contact with the police? And there were some very educated black people that should have been jurors, and they were like, you know, yeah, I got pulled over. I got a ticket. It's no big thing. Okay, excluded. Any black person that came in contact with the police officer in the 30, 40, 20 years that they're alive, they were excluded. This is where we got work to do, because if you're black and you've been in contact with any type of police, and especially a high-profile case like this, you're excluded from the jury. But then they were asking whites, how do you feel about police officers? Oh, my best friend's a police officer. Oh, my uncle's a police officer. My mother dates a police officer. Those are the people that are on the jury. You see, so where's the fairness? If you're black and you've been in contact with jurors, if you're black and you've been in contact with the police, you're excluded from the jury. But if you're white and your best friend or your family friend is a police officer, you're on the jury. So this is what we're dealing with. That's why it's kind of hard. Like, the DA did an excellent job. To me, he should be going to prison, but just that jury thing, you know. And then, you know, I just want to share a couple of things. I'm exhausted, and I forgot to write something. I was asleep on a plane, and you know. And, you know, Wednesday we were in court. I'm pretty sure a lot of you heard that Oscar Grant's mother went to the hospital. You know, and the reason she went to the hospital, we were sitting in the courtroom, and they called the, I can't even say it, the apologist, the guy who tells you how you die and, anthropologist. Yeah. So he was for the defense, but David Stein did an excellent job of breaking him down. And then I couldn't take it no more, so I got up and left. And I wanted to say something so bad, but it was best that I left because I was just like ready to jump over that thing and just man, just choke Michael Raines out just for lies after lies after lies. And what we found out is that not only was Oscar Grant murdered, but Oscar Grant's left side of his skull was crushed.
No.
Yes. His left, that's why his mother, she broke down in the courtroom. She couldn't take it. And when we got outside, they had to take her to the hospital. So you're talking about, you want to seek justice, but this man, before he was murdered, and then you look at Tony Peroni's hands on Oscar Grant's face. And then I remember everyone saying, man, and my son was saying, Dad, you know, his face was black and blue. And then Wednesday we find out that his skull was crushed. You know, I mean, that was hard to swallow right there, you know. And, you know, so, you know, so, yeah, it's a trip, you know. And then, like, Michael Raines is saying, you know, there's another thing I was thinking about. You know, he's saying that, you know, the DA is not seeking the truth. And each police officer that took that stand should be in jail for perjury, because each one of them lied.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And you could see the white supremacy in there, because they even had a police officer from San Leandro, when Oscar got in trouble 4 years ago, come up and he was like, yeah, you know, Oscar Grant was a problem, but the DA broke him down. But just like, you could see that what these police officers do, especially the white ones, you could see that their brotherhood is real tight, but they're dorks, they're stupid, you know. I mean, when these police officers came to the stands, you could just see them, how stupid, how dorky they were. And then when I read Tukey Williams' book, and I was reading one part about Tukey Williams' book, how the police officers, excuse my language, they kept fucking with Tukey when he was in jail. And there was one deputy that just kept messing with Tukey. And then what happened is Tukey broke out of his handcuffs and he chased the guy. And the guy was screaming for his life, help, help, help. But yet you were provoking Tukey, and then he ran into a cage and got away. But this is what I'm saying, like, these police officers, they're like, I mean, if they weren't police officers, they wouldn't even be in the black and brown community, and especially in the black community. But since they get these badges and guns, they feel that they can come in here and do what they want and destroy the, you know, the black community or the brown community. So this has been a learning process. And like I was saying, one lie after another. Then I started thinking, damn, these motherfuckers just tell lie after lie after lie. Then I was thinking about, how many of you heard of Marion Jones?
Yeah.
Marion Jones. Marion Jones was a track star. You know, she was America's hero, track star, won all these gold medals. Marion Jones just had a baby, and they took her to jail for 6 months for perjury and made sure she lost all her endorsements. They did everything they could for perjury. And she went to a federal penitentiary for 6 months. I'm saying, why did Marion Jones go to jail? And these dumb bitches keep lying on a murder case, and nothing is happening to them. Nothing is being said. Even Michael Raines is doing a perjury case. You know, so that's just a trip, you know. And then one experience in the courtroom was, when we were on, how Johannes Mezley, how he was, David Stein was great. I mean, it was insulting. It was very insulting when he started crying about Oscar Grant, how he didn't mean to kill Oscar Grant, that Oscar Grant was looking at him like, and he looked at Oscar and he was like, I'm going to help you. I didn't mean to shoot you. You know, this is what he's telling the jury. And I'm like, shit, are these white jurors going to buy this shit? You know, because he's breaking down, and Wanda gets up, Oscar's mother, and says, give me a break, with them fake tears. And she walks out the courtroom. Then there's Tim Kellings. Tim Killings, he stands up in front of everybody, and he did what everyone wanted to do. He stood up and said, man, save them fucking racist tears for another time. And you know, so he's walking out, and he knows he's about to get arrested and a little beaten, too. So they took him, I mean, as he's walking out, he's looking at Johannes Mezley, and he's telling him, say those fucking tears. And the judge says, arrest him, order him. I want him in contempt of court right now. And Tim's like, you got me. I'm not going nowhere. They rough him up. But the thing I love about Tim, he got out 3 days, 4 days later, and when the media surrounded him, and he said, you know what? They were asking him, so how do you feel? He said, I feel good. I'll do it again. If I had to, I'll do 3 months next time. I'll do 6 months. As long as we get justice, it's not going to bother me. This is what needs to be done, you know. You know, and then, you know, that's why I want to thank Tim. They'll be here tomorrow, but they couldn't make it tonight. Tim, GP, Javon, and Jabari. When you guys see those guys, embrace them, because they were out in Los Angeles with their stomachs hurting for food, but they didn't care. They were out till 1, 2, 3 in the morning just passing out flyers in Watts, Crenshaw. Wherever there was people at, they were there. Talking about Oscar Grant, and they really stepped it up. And I just really want to thank those youngsters. So when you see them, embrace them, take care of them, because they represent it real well. And then there's one more person I really want to thank, and I just can't get him out of my mind, you know, and that's my son, Jackie Bryson.
That's right,
you know, you don't know what love is, you know, like I could tell you I love you, and you know, that could be it. But when you have a son or a daughter, but in this case, like my son, when I seen him on that stand and they were setting him up, you know, they showed a big mugshot of him to the jury. They showed the worst picture you could ever pick out. They were setting him up. They were bringing in witness to say, yeah, he did this, and he was the biggest guy. One witness said he was the biggest guy on the train, just knocking people out and stuff like that. So Michael Raines was getting ready, you know, like everyone's like, whoa, Michael Raines is about to lick his chops. So, but what I'm so proud of, just watching my son in that stand and going blow for blow with Michael Raines. And just Michael Raines was just trying to chop him up, but my son ended up chopping Michael Raines up. And then what I loved about him, but what I loved about it is, one, like I'm looking at him, that's Johannes Mezley, and Michael Raines is over here asking my son's question, and my son is just looking at Johannes Mezley like this, and Michael Raines is asking him questions, and my son is just consistently looking at Johannes Mezley answering his questions, and that was frustrating Michael Raines. And then he asked, he said something. He showed a video of Oscar being shot and my son being handcuffed, and my son was just going in circles, and then Michael Raines tried to accuse my son of leaving him, and everyone started crying because he said, you were getting ready to leave your friend. My son started crying. He said, man, I would never leave my friend. I would never leave Oscar. And then he started, you know, him and Michael Raines started going at it, and he told Michael Raines, he said, you know, you're sitting up here, you're labeling Oscar, me, my little brother, and he's looking at Johannes Mezley as he's saying this, and he's saying, you're labeling us as the bad guys. You're labeling us as thugs. And he just kept going on. I was just like, I couldn't believe my son was going toe to toe for one of the most powerful lawyers in California. He represents all crooked police officers. He's the reason why these police officers do murders, do tear up the black community and are back on the streets. And, you know, then my son, he looks at Johannes Mezley, and he goes, you know, you're trying to, as Michael Raines is talking to him, and he looks at Johannes Mezley, and he says, you're trying to label me and Oscar and my brother and my friend as the bad ones. He said, that's the bad one right there. He's the one that killed Oscar Grant. And then you want to turn around and label us as the bad one when he was supposed to be protecting us and stopping Tony Peroni from what he was doing. So it just got heated. But I was so proud of my son for standing up to him, you know, and they were just going tick for tack. And I was just so proud of my son. And yesterday in court, so yesterday when they were deliberate, my son made a statement, and it's one of the statements that are getting Johannes Mesley, why he has to go to trial, I mean, why second degree is being placed on him, is that, this is another reason I'm proud of my son, he finally got to tell his story. And he looked at Johannes Mesley while we were in trial, and he said, right before, you know, he said, Johannes Mesley saying he couldn't get Oscar Grant's hands, and then my son said the reason he couldn't get Oscar Grant's hand is how could he get Oscar Grant's hands when you have Tony Peroni and Johannes Mesley, two guys over 250 pounds on them, and Oscar's telling him, I can't breathe. I'm trying to give you my hands. I can't breathe, and both of you are on me. And then he's just telling them that what Oscar's last words were, and then he says that Johannes Mesley says, my son said that Johannes Mesley's last words were like, fuck this shit, and he clocked his gun, got his gun out, and just shot Oscar. So right there, the judge said, by Jackie saying that, that qualifies him to go to jail for 40 to 50 years. You know, so hopefully we can get him to go for something, you know. So, but I just want to thank everybody. And the L.A., excuse me, one more thing, I want to thank the L.A. Coalition, because every time we come out that courtroom, there's always people out there just supporting us, just supporting Oakland. You know. Man, this is just a hurtful experience, you know, because I think of Oscar Grant when I'm in that courtroom. You know, then I think about the injustice that was done to Tukey Williams. Then I think about, I got to write him. I ain't seen him in a while. So, Crystal, if you see him, you know, I ain't been to see Kevin Cooper in a while. And Kevin Cooper's such an inspiration to me, you know. Here he is in the belly of the beast. And that guy has more heart than I do, and I'm free. You know, that guy's sitting on death row. And, man, you just sit here and you just start thinking about all the injustice that's being done all over the world. I mean, all over the United States. So hopefully when we get this victory, this will give us more encouragement, you know, to keep fighting and fighting and fighting, because we could do it, you know. But that's it. All right. Thank you.
Of course. We brought all these people here to hear you.
You know, I just want to recognize one guy. You guys should be proud of. He's a part of your organization. Howard, right here. Stand up. This guy. I mean, this guy caught a Greyhound to Chicago from L.A. That's a lot. And then every time I come out the courtroom in Los Angeles, he's always right there. And now I'm in Oakland and I see him. You know, so he's a good, he should be recognized.
Okay, so we have plenty of time for discussion, and I'm going to try to give you 2 or 3 minutes, questions, but also comments, but want to get a good discussion going. I'm going to ask Liliana and Jack to come in every, 2 to 5 questions or comments to try to keep the pace going along. And then I'm going to give them plenty of time to wrap up at the end. So even if your question doesn't get answered right away, we will bat clean up at the end. So please don't. We run it a little differently here, and hopefully that differently turns out to be better discussion. I'm going to ask for one favor, though. If someone who is near that water cooler could bring up 3 glasses of water. I know I'm thirsty. I bet Jack is, and I think Liliana is too. So if somebody could bring us some water, it would be totally great. I'm also going to repeat questions just because the mic is recording, so I'll repeat it so we can hear it on the tape later. Yep, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Paul Sutter from Oakland. I also go to Laney Community College. I just want to talk a little bit about the trial. Not only did they ban blacks off of the jury, but they also banned 3 very important pieces of evidence. The first one being that Officer Tony Peroni, who instigated this whole incident and pulled all those guys off the train, he actually said, and forgive the language, he actually called...
be careful.
Called them B-word, ass, N-word. Mm-hmm. But that was kept out of evidence. Second piece of evidence that was kept out was testimony from Officer Grant's partner, who actually talked to him on the cell phone before they started to hold Officer down and actually, and then before the incident. And she could testify that he was both nervous and scared. And they left that out because it's really hard to explain why someone would be resisting arrest if they were both scared and if they were nervous and if they were calm enough to actually, like, you know, call their spouse and talk about what was going on. And then the third piece of evidence that they decided to leave out of the trial was a synchronization of videos that actually showed that Oscar had both his hands behind his back at the time that he was killed. And I think we just have to be very clear about, you know, what the defense case is and why it's going to take 10 hours for Reigns to try to explain his client. That's because there is absolutely no excuse for this at all. And the only way that you can try to explain it is try to paint the people that they were trying to arrest as a threat. But the, you know, but the first piece of evidence I talked about, that really disgusting racist language, I mean, they left that out. So because if they left it in, then I think it would be the cops that have to explain, you know, why it was that they were being so, they were being so awful. And then also, if they were resisting arrest, with all these facts that we know and how aggressive the cops were, then I think that, I mean, why wouldn't you resist arrest if you're being hunted down by some racist armed thugs?
Are there either questions for Jack or Liliana or comments that maybe is something that you've, an experience you've had or some take that you have on what's going on and what we should think about in this kickoff for our conference? Go ahead, sir.
Thank you. I guess my question is for Liliana about this, and I will read the Nation article as soon as I can. But you mentioned something about the economic situation being a major factor in the reducing prison population right now. At that trend. But I'm recalling the choice of the municipality of Seattle to build a new prison at the time when the state was trying to close prisons. And I can't remember, maybe you could help me out here or someone else from the audience. Wasn't there some sort of kickback system in place or something going on where the city was actually supposed to benefit somehow financially, even though they were like fronting a whole bunch of money to build the prison? I thought there was some way that they were trying to actually gain from building a new prison, and that would be something that we need to be aware of and counter.
Except for that question, it's a long question, so I won't just repeat it. But maybe we can put that on and come back. Brother Jesse, yeah.
Thanks. Yeah, you mentioned the prison in Seattle, and I'm from Seattle, so I thought I'd mention about that. Actually, it's a victory for us in Seattle that we really worked hard trying to link the fact that they're closing 5 schools in the Seattle Public Schools, and then they can find money to build a new prison facility to incarcerate these people that aren't able to find jobs and don't have, you know, the proper education they deserve. And it was a victory for us that they announced just recently that they're not going to build that prison at this time. So, that Nation article, because I think some of the encouraging signs of it in terms of the prison population declining, you know, shrinking state budgets, states being more shy about building new prisons. It mentions that Obama's new drug czar, Bill Kurlikowski, is not going to prosecute medical marijuana use, and there's some encouraging signs like that. But I also know that Bill Kurlikowski was the chief of police in Seattle. And might not be prosecuting medical marijuana, but like Seattle is not a chocolate city. Like there is not a lot of, it's about 8, 9, 10% African American. And the drug arrests in Seattle were 50% African American under Bill Krulikowski. So I think I think that article is a bit of a rosy picture in terms of like the war on crime is on the way out, was sort of the way that I read it, and that Obama was campaigning against the war on drugs, and now he's got this czar who's not prosecuting medical use, and the economy is forcing us not to build as many jails, and so it's sort of on the way out. You know, and actually, like in Seattle, where I live, you can look at the last year, and this is the last year of what we've seen captured on video has been a teenage girl beaten in a prison cell by a guard. Then you had a man who the cops threw down on the ground, kicked him in the head, and said, "We're going to kick the Mexican piss out of you." Home, right? That was caught on video. Then most recently, we had a 17-year-old girl who was committing the offense of jaywalking, and she was punched in the face by the police officer, right? So this is just the last year, and this is, you notice like Oscar Grant, we got a case because it's caught on video. How many of these cases are happening that are not caught on video that we never get to prosecute? So I think it's good that the prison population for the first time is declining slightly, but you talk about a city, you know, a country with over 2 million people incarcerated, and I think it's absolutely right what Liliana said. We're going to have to build. We can't just rest on that small victory. We're going to have to really organize and redouble the fight.
All right, thank you.
I have two more speakers, and then I'm going to recognize Pat to talk a little bit about a fun pitch that we have for the campaign to end the death penalty. So the next person is going to be Kianga, followed by Dana, and then I'm going to have Pat.
Yeah, thank you to the presenters for really a great presentation. I wanted to also say something about the declining prison population, because I think on the one hand, yes, it's about state budgets and you know, the releasing of prisoners to try to alleviate that. But I think it's also important that we not look at that in a vacuum, because we have to look at what people are being released into, especially for African American men and women, because a lot of times people are going back to communities with high double-digit unemployment. I mean, in cities like Milwaukee, which has the highest black unemployment in the country, 53%, Chicago South Side, 43%, New York City, 35%, Washington, D.C., 25%, so on and so forth. And this is what people are being released into. But we also have to think about what, even being released from prison, what the criminalization of a whole generation of young African Americans, of what that means. The millions of people who have lost the right to vote because of felony convictions for drug offenses, the exacerbation of unemployment, the fact that you have the rising expense of college, and if you have a felony conviction, you cannot get a student loan, which for many people means that college is an impossibility. If you have a felony conviction, you cannot get public housing, which we're already dealing with a population who is in poverty and who need, you know, some sort of assistance to get back on their feet, now excluded from public housing, excluded from many welfare resources. So it's not enough to just say that people are being released from prison. We have to look at the entire situation. And that also, in addition to that, regardless of what is happening with the prisons, we can't disconnect that from the daily terrorism that police are executing or exacting in African-American communities across this country. I'm from Chicago, and hardly a day goes by without a news story that's buried in the paper about cops shooting some black kid to death and, you know, all of a sudden finding a gun on them or whatever. But there are regular reports of police killings and murders in these neighborhoods, aside from the random run-of-the-mill, not random, crime, but run-of-the-mill police brutality and harassment, which is why I think the discussion about taking on the entire criminal justice system and looking at this in totality is very important, and to not get narrowly focused on, you know, the decline in prison population, even though it's not insignificant, it has to be looked at in this wider context.
Great. I'm going to try to just put my hand up and signal to you when you have about 30 seconds left, but people have been really good about the time limit, so I just want to thank you for that. Dana is followed by Gerald. Gerald will be followed by Pat. Gerald, yes?
Oh, thank you. Thank you. My name is Gerald, and I work with the New Year's Movement of Justice, and, which is a part of the Coalition for Justice in Boston Grant. It's kind of interesting. She actually said much of what I wanted to share with you, and that is, you know, people talk that bullshit about violence. But let me tell you something. The police is stark violence every time. People don't go to a event within the amount where we don't start going. They start hitting people, gassing them, disrespecting them, and people react. Especially when you have young people who have not been politically active and are not working under the discipline of a cafe organization. The people don't do what they normally would do, that is fight back. We need support. Now, we've got a situation here where I can tell you right now, they are trying to stage a provocation. Because I was at the meeting when we called for this gathering. And that's what we call for, a gathering. You know you're going to have the anarchists say, yeah, burn it down. Anarchists will be anarchists. But the point is, the police will stage provocation. And they are trying. Because it don't matter how many departments they get. It don't matter. Because if the mob show up, it's on. Don't kid yourself. When I was in the Panthers, our position was that we were opposed to having a riot in Oakland. And you know what? Oakland was one of the few cities where there was no riot. And the reason is organization. You see, when you have organization, stuff don't get crazy. People understand what's going on. You see? And they have an intimate relationship with the revolutionary organization. That doesn't exist here. So I'll tell you right now, I don't know what's going to happen, but I know this. It's better if people people that do have a political understanding show up. Mm-hmm. You start off by showing up, so you got some leaflets. And Jack mentioned the young man that was stranded in L.A., but, you know, continue to work on. We got a little couple over there. Help us out. Thank you very much.
Oh, us social movements, we have lots of heart and little money. So, but I encourage people to help out with that. But I also want to ask Pat to say just a few words about the monthly sustainer program with the campaigns and the death penalty.
You can give your dollars and change to what Gerald was talking about for the New Year's movement, and you can give me your credit card number. The monthly sustainer program is what sustains the campaign. It really does. And I want to urge you to buy a latte for the campaign a month, buy a beer for the campaign. You can do it for as little as $5 a month. If you do, you'll get a DVD of the Zen event that we have in Chicago. If you'll sign up, it truly does sustain us. One of the things that it does, Cameron talked about supporting former prisoners. We have hired Mark Connors, who spent 28 years inside. He's one of John Burgess' torture victims. He got out last August. We hired him. So that will help pay his salary, along with just keep sustaining us. So I'm hesitant to anybody who wants one of these forms. I'll hand it to you now, or you can come back and get
one of those. Come on. And if you want, I bet Dave Zirin would probably sign that, because Dave is interviewing Howard in that great DVD that we have. In the black, yep.
Hi, I'm Kira from Portland, and I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the things that have been happening in Portland recently. We've been Aaron Campbell, for example, was a young man who was emotionally distraught at the death of his brother. And in an attempt to get him help, the police were called, and instead of getting help, his mother got two sons in the war. And also recently in Portland, the same police officer who murdered James Cassie, a mentally unstable man, homeless man, who was also guilty of holding a woman's face to a lit burner in a forced entry by the police in her home, also shot a 12-year-old girl at a match ring with a beanbag gun, a 12-year-old African-American girl. Portland also doesn't exactly have a very high African-American population or Latino population at all. And the recent attacks, I mean, it's a legacy of attacks on black and brown people and on the homeless. And also recently, an emotionally disturbed young man was shot 37 times. He shot a police officer in the leg. It was discovered later that he was suffering from all sorts of mental and emotional problems. 37 times? These people aren't here to protect and serve us. They're here to divide us with fear. They're here to keep us chained down. They're here to oppress minorities. And you know what? I want to echo what everyone here is saying. Like, we need to get together, rattle those chains until they break.
I just wanted to add that the struggle for justice for Oscar Grant and Jack Bryson's sons and the others is not even close to over. No matter what happens with Mesereau, if he gets off or gets a ridiculous drug or is convicted of involuntary manslaughter or something, it's going to go to the Justice Department. Even if he is convicted, Tony Peroni needs to be held to account legally as well, not just for perjury but for his violence, for hurting those young men. Today, the state legislature, the Senate, passed a version of supposedly a civilian oversight board for BART police, but the struggle last year was that the community activists were working with BART on was that either the board of directors would have oversight authority and be able to issue discipline to officers, or the civilian board itself would be able to do that. And BART agreed to that, but then behind closed doors made a secret deal with CORAC, which is a police lobby that's actually paying for Mesereau's defense now. And that secret deal meant that the power of discipline remains with the general manager, who did nothing last year, and the police chief, who also did nothing. We have a new police chief now, but having the authority, no elected officials, no civilians, just don't be fooled if Bart starts trying to trumpet that as some sort of big change. And the fight will go on.
And now moving it out to Chicago, Alan.
Yeah, I'm Alan, and I'm from Chicago, and I just wanted to say one thing. So I don't think that there was anyone I talked to before that verdict came down against John Birch who was confident that it was going to go the way it did, actually. I mean, we're talking about vilely corrupt, you know, political establishment there, and powerful people standing behind Birch, the mayor of the city of Chicago, was the attorney, the prosecuting attorney, state attorney, right, at the time that Birch was carrying out that torture, right? So the unraveling that takes place as a result of this is profound. And I think it says a couple things. Number one, that jury was set up by the defense to act in exactly the same way as being described in the Messerly trial here, which was, you know, that, you know, the cops are just doing their duty, you don't want to convict a cop, and you know what, they didn't buy it, and they didn't accept it. One of the things that one of the jurors said was that they deliberated about was the name of John Burgess' fishing boat, Vigilante, which gives you a sense of what exactly people were thinking about the cops there. But it also says something else, I think, which is the ongoing campaign that took place that kept this issue in the news, because there was nothing about the city establishment, the federal establishment, that was going to go after John Birch and the torture and make sure that, you know, any kind of vindication actually took place. It was only the result of, you know, not many people coming out, but a long series of demonstrations over years of time, of people carrying that out, of being the connection between what Liliana described about the highlights, the periods of time that we celebrate. There's a connection between them, which is those activists on the ground who made sure those demonstrations happened, made sure that the people got together who needed to make sure there was a movement there. And the other thing that was important was giving a face, you know, as you described, giving a face, a human face, to this whole issue. Because, you know, this the Birch thing goes back to the struggle against the death penalty in general in Illinois, where George Ryan, a former Republican governor of all things, imposed a you know, moratorium on the death penalty and then eventually commuted all the sentences on death row. He said the reason that he did that, one of the chief things that he described in talking about it, was the meetings that he had with the family members of people on death row and how those people actually changed him, as much as the great lawyers who made the arguments as well. You know, that's really you know, an important thing. I think what Jack can do, what Jack has done tonight, is gives us a sense of exactly how powerful that is. It's something that we can do just to connect this to the rest of the weekend, that it's not just about this issue, but this issue is part of claiming this society for what's, for all of us, for what's decent and human and moral about what we can be, and taking it away from the people who do the opposite.
I have you, Carol, but I have time for like one or two more people, but that's going to be it. Oh, Jack, you want to come back? I always have time for Jack.
No, don't do that. What I wanted to ask you, because I was in Los Angeles, and, you know, there was a couple, Pat had called me, then some other people had called me. So then I was like, wow, damn, this dude went to, they convicted him. But what I wanted to ask you, Alan, because just sitting in that courtroom right now, it's like a mind-boggling game. Like, I'm like, fuck, I would give $1 million to know what each juror is thinking. You know, because we know this man committed murder, but history's not on our side. So what I think about all the time, and lately I've just been thinking every time I'm in that courtroom about John Birch, what was the makeup of the juror?
More white than black. There were several African Americans on the jury, but as opposed to this case, but it was disproportionately white compared to where the cases being held.
Wow, because that's kind of scary, because there's no blacks on the Oscar Grant jury. So, and now that we're down to the last minute, it's just like I was saying, you know, it's like you're staring at a jury and you're like, damn, what are they thinking? Like today, you know, it's just like, you know, like the fate of what happens in California or in Oakland is in these jurors' hands. Do these jurors really know? They know this man is guilty for murder, but do they care enough just because he's a police officer? And they say, F it, we don't care if Los Angeles and Oakland burns, we just want this police officer, you know, off. I mean, it's just a mind-boggling game right now about these jurors. But I do know one thing, we do have to educate, like I said, because this system is set up. That's why, look at, they, like, when this trial was moved, and Michael Rain said that this trial has to be moved because blacks aren't fair jurors, blacks aren't good jurors, and, you know, stuff like that. This is why our prisons are filled up. What makes white jurors so superior? If white jurors were so good, then why is Mumia in jail? Why is Kevin Cooper in jail? Why is Troy Davis in jail? Why are all these prisons filled with black men that were judged by 12 white folks?
Is there one more person okay, you're going to have to be the last one, though. Yeah. Okay, you and no, not right now though. You'll be the last one at the end. Go ahead. Yeah.
First, my name is Jesse. I'm from Oakland. First, I just wanted to thank you both for being here and sharing what you do, and also for everyone sharing what you do, because I think these spaces are super important. I actually had a question for both of you though. We know that our incarceration system is totally broken. Whether you look at racial statistics or how cops let each other off. You're both involved in, or you both spoke about different struggles within the court system. So my question is about how do you balance an idea and a vision for like transformative justice and a different kind of criminal justice system or justice system with the work that you do now?
So the question is, how do you balance transformative or restorative justice with the work that we do now? I'm just repeating it for the tape, so. Let's hold that, because that is a question I think that's probably on a lot of people's minds. Robin, then Carol, and then, go ahead. Oh, sorry, you. Yeah.
My name is Randy from LA. I want to go back to what Liliana made about how activism can change, how we talk about these issues, and really transform how success, and she mentioned how, you know, the campaign had definitely, you know, refers to the death penalty as lynching, and then it talks about, you know, the same basic horrible acts just with maybe more advanced technology or transition. But it's the same, you know, it goes back to some people or actually bringing forward the voices of people from death row and people's families and to really talk about this not as an abstract policy discussion, but as, you know, here's what's happening to real human beings. And actually, can you remind me of the name of the man who died in jail after being put in prison for the bad checks?
Adam Montoya.
Okay. So for passing that check, was locked up, treated like an animal, denied the treatment for the illnesses that he had, and ultimately died in prison for that. And when I think about that, I mean, it makes me think about subprime loans, it makes me think about mortgage-backed securities and credit default swaps. These things to me are fancy names for bad checks.
Yeah.
That the crooks on Wall Street told us worth a whole lot, you know, but it ended up being worth nothing. And we're not seeing any of those guys being sent to jail or anything like that. And I think contrasting the crooks, like how ordinary people get treated by the system, to also the real and horrible and massive crimes that are being perpetrated by the system. It's not a toaster grant. It's not his friends and stuff like that. It's threats. Society, it's the system that we live under. That's a threat to our safety. That's a threat to our futures. Whether it's DP or whether it's the crooks on Wall Street. And I think we have a tremendous power to not only directly challenge the criminal justice system and on cases like these, but also connected us to. There's a reason why we are very insecure in society, because we live under a system of capitalism that actually commits crimes that would make anything that any individual could do pale by comparison. And that.
Carol's followed by Murr.
the insanity of killing people, having a death penalty, especially innocent people, proven innocent, like Leon Mall, Roy Davis, Kevin Cooper, absolutely proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that they're innocent, and the system going full steam ahead to try to execute them. I think it's really appropriate that this subject is the subject of a socialism conference, because I would argue that the capitalist system, and especially now that it's in its dying throes, although it doesn't look like it, it is, it's in crisis, it's got to have wars all over, it's got to have 2 million people in prison in the richest country in the world. They want this, and they need this. They need the death penalty to prop up a capitalist system that has the greatest inequality between the rich and the poor. That's the only way to keep it going, is to have this incredibly repressive apparatus and to undo the rights that have been won in the courts, like to be represented on a jury of your peers. They're violating these all over the place. And I really would urge people to read. There's an article by Kevin Cooper's lawyer that explains all the ways that the that their own precedents are being violated now with the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act and other repressive measures that have been passed under Democrats and Republicans, but it's all for a purpose. Purpose is to keep the imperialists in power in this country and try to prevent a revolt against it. Really, we have to keep doing this work. This work is critical, and people can be won over to it. But the ultimate work to really get rid of this system is socialist revolution.
Murr is going to follow by Jillian, and that's going to have to be the last person for this part of the discussion.
Hi, I'm Murr. I'm from San Francisco. And I want to quote one of the highly paid, I think he quoted his own prices, about $100,000, consultants that the defense hired to get the jury, to get the trial moved. And he said, the defense's measure of this case, that the long racist history of police violence against members of the black community in Oakland meant eventually didn't get their copy.
That's what they said.
It's just absolutely disgusting, you know, and I think that, you know, in Oakland, in the Bay Area, one of the things we're kind of left with is the sense of, you know, what will it take to really involve, you know, really integrate civil rights movement in this area, because this case has been, you know, in some ways, the perfect case to show exactly what they have always done. You know, and I think that you know, we've seen quite a bit, but I think that sort of, you know, building a movement is going to be it's going to be sort of a longer process than what we've seen in front of us. But what I see is that, honestly, that guy was right. We are angry here about what happened. You know, and I actually think that means that they should, you know, suffer the consequences of what they did and not avoid them by trying to move the trial. But it often comes down, I think, you know, in what we're going to do, to sort of the question of what exactly, you know, what did Oscar Grant do or did not do? And I think that as activists, it's important to highlight that he did not do a damn thing except be on the train 9 o'clock that night. But also, you know, what if he had been talking about it? It is not a capital crime. What if he had, you know, committed, you know, any number of things that you know, in the eyes of prosecutors were the eyes of, you know, totally justified murdering him. You know, I think what we need to do is, as a movement, is raise the question of, you know, why is it that somebody can spend 30, 40 years in prison for something that is totally nonviolent, that has no, you know, real effect on anyone's life? Why is it that that crimes that are committed because of poverty, addiction, are treated as though, that they deserve, you know, decades removed. So, is the only way to explain that. And I think that building civil rights movement on every other case, like Oscar Grant, means, you know, also that I think we need to say, you know, this prison system is built on, you know, maybe they did it. I don't really know. You know, I think that you know, what it really comes down to is we need a mental health system. Besides the prison system, you know, we need an end to poverty, and we need real rehab that can help people establish their lives again, you know, beyond drugs and alcohol, which I think a lot of our, you know, communities from that. That, to me, is restorative justice.
Jillian's next, and then I'm going to give Jack and Liliana a few minutes to come back, but I have a few announcements before they come up as well.
Hi, I'm Jillian. I'm a teacher in L.A. I just wanted to throw out an idea about the cuts in prison spending, at least in California. I don't think it's insignificant that schools not prisons has been a huge slogan for many years, and that people have been pointing out the fact that prison spending so far outstrips education spending in states like California. I mean, it was the front cover of the LA Times, California number one in prison spending, number 48 in education. And I think that they actually just didn't have a response to that. Now, their cuts in education are probably outpacing their cuts in prison spending, unfortunately, at this point. But I think that people have been raising the question of messed up priorities, and we have to continue to do that. And then just on the question of legal lynching, I just wanted to bring up the case of Sergio Hernandez, the 14-year-old boy murdered by the Border Patrol in Ciudad Juarez. On the question of who's the threat, apparently the Border Patrol website posted that Border Patrol agents were assaulted at the border by several individuals armed with rocks, and they were forced to defend themselves and their fellow agents. A 14-year-old boy throwing a rock at the Border Patrol, I wonder why he's throwing a rock at Border Patrol. And I just was very struck by what you described your son being able to do in the courtroom. I think that's so hard because they pen you in to feel defensive, like you got to defend yourself. And the whole idea that he turned it around,
yeah.
And he said, "This is who are the real criminals." And so I just think that that's so much what we have to go back to. I mean, I agree with what people said. This is an era in which they're desperate to get us to blame somebody, and immigrants is a big one of them. And they're desperate to get us to blame somebody because of what an awful crisis our system is in. And we have to keep turning it around, not only preventing them from targeting us, but also showing who's really to blame. So.
My announcements are that Socialism 2010 is thrilled to welcome comrades from the victorious University of Puerto Rico strike that just ended a couple of weeks ago. They will be speaking on Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. in the Luxembourg Room for those who'd like to participate in the discussion about the lessons from the successful two-month strike and occupation. Number two is the Friday evening and Sunday afternoon rallies have been moved upstairs to the Calvin Simmons Ballroom. Calvin Simmons was not a revolutionary. We have not renamed that room. And that Saturday, 7 p.m. class struggle of unionism can be revived meeting has been moved to the Collentai Room. And then I also just want to say that books hold the ideas of the things that we've been discussing tonight. There's Christian Parenti's Lockdown America, Police Prisons in the Age of Crisis. There are two issues of our journal that I'd like to point out, the International Socialist Review, Old Racism in the New South, and Civil Rights and Civil Wrongs, Racism in America Today. These books and many others are unavoidable in the book room. But I see books as messages from people who fought before us that they send forward into the future, and they're how we talk to each other about what's working, what's not working, so we don't have to reinvent the wheel every freaking time we go through this. So really, the books are there, the magazine articles are there to help us in our struggles, and I hope that you will really take a look at those things. And now for a wrap-up, I'd like to ask Liliana, you're going to come up too. I'm going to have Liliana go first, or do you want to go first? Jack wants to go first. Come on up, Jack.
I got to get back. I got to go back to Los Angeles right quick. What I wanted to say, since I've been in Los Angeles, it's two experiences that really, like, kind of tripped me out about how people are. You know, like, we have a young man that was murdered in front of the world on a platform, and his friends were assaulted and jailed and all that. But while I'm in Los Angeles, we're at the courtroom, and the weirdest thing happens. It's the Michael Jackson trial, too. And when we get to the courtroom, I'm like, all these people are saying they got signs for, like, justice for Michael Jackson. And I'm laughing. I'm like, no disrespect, but I'm just saying, what the fuck? Where do these people, I mean, what are they thinking? This man, he knew what he was doing, but here we are with Oscar Grant, and they don't even know what's going on, but they want justice for Michael Jackson. But so there was about 500 people from Los Angeles from the Oscar Grant Coalition and the L.A. Coalition. And then there was like another 500 people from the Michael Jackson thing. So what had happened is CNN, helicopters, and everywhere, they were just flying all over the place. And the Jackson family, they were trying to give their press conference. So what happened is the Oscar Grant movement took over that press conference. And they just, and then the Michael Jackson people, they were like, you know, give us our chance. Be quiet. You were there, huh? You were there. And so it just, and then people just started coming from everywhere. You seen it. They were hollering, we want justice for Oscar Grant. People were just coming out off the streets. And they shut down the Michael Jackson Coalition, whatever you call it, Justice for Michael Jackson. But it was just, it was a trip, like, and then another thing happened in Los Angeles that just, I don't understand people, like, the Los Angeles Lakers won the NBA championship. I mean, there was thousands of people just running to the streets, going crazy, wearing Kobe Bryant jerseys. And Kobe Bryant don't, excuse my language, but Kobe Bryant don't give a fuck about none of these people. You know what I mean? And so where is your morals, you know, I don't mean to knock Kobe, but what I'm saying, you got people that are just crying and screaming, Los Angeles Lakers, I love you, Kobe. Just, you know, and these people don't even give back to their communities. You know, they don't even help the communities from what I see. But, you know, it's just like, I'm like really tripping off, where's people's heads at? You know, like, we have a genocide on young black and brown men. I mean, I met a young man from Portland who wrote a book called The Enemies in Blue, Kristen Williams. Very, very knowledgeable young man. And I was reading, I was going through his pages. Since 1976 to like 1996, and then he stops right there. Well, I stopped because I didn't finish reading because I've been busy. But in that time, it's been 8,576 black men killed by police officers. And none have been prosecuted. None. So, you know, that's why it's so important. I mean, just for once, can we just get a victory in this Oscar Grant murder trial? And then we could set the precedents there. You know, we could, like, after this, we just got to keep fighting. I'm new to this. And people are asking me, well, what are you going to do after this? You only got like a week left. I'm like, I'm going to keep fighting. You know, I don't know what I'm going to fight for. I don't know what I'm going to say or what I'm going to do, because I don't even know what I be saying sometimes. But but it's just an honor to be around everyone that's on the same page, that, you know, that wants to fight for justice, you know. I think that's the clearest way to clear your conscience, is to stand up and do something. It's not what you got on your shoes or how much money you got or what kind of car you drive. It's what you do for your community and what you do for people who are victimized by police or by this system, you know. So that's what we got to do. We got to keep fighting, and it can be done. It may seem like, I mean, look, it's been a lifetime, you know. Look at George Jackson. We're still fighting for what he was fighting for. Che Guevara, everything that these great men stood up and fought for, I mean, you know, it can be done, you know, and it will be done. So it's up to us. So I just want to thank everybody. Thank you.
That's a tough act to follow, but I just wanted to quickly touch on some of the questions that were asked, if I can still remember them clearly. Just on the question you raised about, I'm glad you brought up the example about the municipality versus the state versus, you know, often what's seen even as states are reducing their prison budgets and, you know, kind of trying to find ways to reduce or to cut their prison population is that the federal government or other forms, you know, other levels of government are working at cross purposes. And that's I mean, extremely typical. And we see that now with the Obama administration. Unfortunately, even as these kind of innovative state initiatives are taking place, the federal government under Obama continues to throw money, actually is throwing more money at some of the more the failed, you know, initiatives of the Clinton era that throw more money towards prison building, towards putting cops on the streets. I mean, hopelessly unoriginal, counterproductive, ultimately racist criminal justice policies are being funded by the Obama administration, even as the states are trying to work against that. So there's this kind of irony there. And we see that on a, we saw that on a very dramatic scale. Oh, and these things, prison, I mean, building new prisons for forever have been kind of pitched as like this great jobs kind of opportunity. You know, we're going to revitalize the economy of this one local, you know, locality by building a prison. And talk about unoriginal. And yet this is exactly what the Democrats were saying when they were trying to generate support for Gitmo North in Thompson, Illinois, you know, this great, innovative Guantanamo they're going to bring onto U.S. soil, you know, this beyond supermax prison. So unfortunately, a lot of the same ideas, the old ideas that haven't worked, are continue to be rolled out, especially when it comes to the federal government. And it's a shame that the Obama administration has embraced those same things. And then to the question of what, how do we, I'm not going to be able to word this as artfully as it was worded before, but how do we balance our kind of vision for an alternative, I guess, while we do this work? I mean, for me personally, it's sometimes it's hard to see past the kind of incredibly dense, you know, just the cumulative challenge is so thick, you know, when you're looking ahead at what you're doing, that it's hard to see past that sometimes. In New York, we have a book club where we, you know, we try to read sort of visionary books like Angela Davis's Our Prison's Obsolete. That's a really good one. It's kind of a, it's, you know, it kind of feels like indulging in a bit of fantasy almost, but it's also really an important exercise in that, wait a minute, we're so caught up in what exists, but like, what if, you know, what if it didn't exist this way? And it's actually a really good way to refresh the way we think about these things and the way we talk about these things. So that's one way. The other thing that's a little more concrete that I would say in New York, especially we've been doing, and I know the campaign as a whole has been doing, is to refuse to kind of allow ourselves to be painted into a political corner when it comes to discussions of what an alternative to the death penalty is. And the way we've done that in the campaign is that we took the position some years ago that we were not going to embrace life without parole as a suitable alternative to the death penalty. And for me, that's been... thank you. And this is an area of focus for me now, and I'm actually hoping to spend in the coming months to spend a full year kind of looking at the intersection between life without parole and the death penalty, because I actually think that that decision is going to become more and more important as the years go by, because what we're finding is, again, even as death sentences are on the decline, life without parole sentences are up higher than ever in a way that I think people just have not even considered, you know, what this means. Even as prison populations are going down, what does it mean that we're locking up more and more people and throwing away the key? And you know, isn't it kind of just a different spin on the same principle, you know, the expendability of human potential and human life? So I think it's really important that, you know, that is thinking beyond the alternatives that exist right in front of us. And we've caught a lot of slack and have a lot of debates with other abolitionist groups for taking that position. But at the end of the day, you know, life without parole, it has the same pitfalls. It's also racist. It also condemns, you know, the poor, the innocent, the most vulnerable members of our society to die in prison. And that's the reality. And so that's one way in which we kind of, you know, try to envision alternatives beyond the ones that we're told exist. I think that's very important. And I wanted to thank, I can't remember, a number of people spoke to, you know, what's going on around the country, but it's especially here in California, I just can never get over just the heinous situation, you know, with, I think a lot of the reason that California has had to refocus on its prison, you know, crisis is the scandals that made it across the country about overpopulation. Where was the prison where there was that horrible sort of stampede situation in Vacaville, I think it was, where it's just these horribly overcrowded prisons are just death traps, literally. And then the fact that the healthcare system in prisons in California is in receivership, this being the same prison system that they're trying to send Montel Johnson to, you know, completely unable to care for him. So, I mean, I agree with those who pushed back on the Nation article, and I'm glad some people have, you know, thought about it. And I think these are the conversations we need to have with kind of more mainstream liberals who are saying, oh, well, the drug war is over, and, you know, states are kind of, you know, catching on to prison reform. It's a lot more complicated than that. There's a hell of a lot of work to be done, and it gives me so much confidence and hope to have the kinds of discussions we've had in this room tonight. It's really invigorating, and I thank you guys.
That's it for the meeting. I want to thank everybody for coming. This is just the beginning. Please join us for the rest of the weekend. Welcome to socialism.